Good morning, everyone. Alicia here. How are you doing? I hope you are well. Today, we're going to talk about a few really cool ideas from this book, The Soul's Code, In Search of Character and Calling by James Hillman. And just to give you a quick idea of the point of this is changing our perspective on how we view our children and seeing this time being like stuck at home with our kids that aren't normally here. You know, for many of you, your kids are not normally at home this much, and there's so much online and so much about like color-coded charts and all the things that you can do and the astronauts that are reading from space, and you hear about all the fun ideas and you're like, oh, I should be doing all these things. And then you also hear the people talking about, like, I can't do that. The chart fell out the window. The kids that did that didn't work for them. There were tears the first week. And so now we're trying this. So we're going with a looser schedule. Because I think so much of the focus right now is on trying to continue to measure up to the current level of expectations, how much, you know, studying curriculum and material kids were getting at school. There's this sense of like, oh, they've got to keep doing that amount. And I think everybody's having a good conversation about how much is necessary and how much to just relax. And it's just a couple of months and then it's going to be summer. And my kids just got really loud in the background. But I want to talk about how another thing that we can focus on this just so much farther reaching is our kids' image and destiny and character and just who each of your children are and how unique they are and how this is such a beautiful, unique opportunity to watch them and to interact with them and to slow down and to just really be with them. And I want to encourage you to set your intention to really experience your children and to ask spirit to open your eyes to see things that you might have been dismissing or that your kid might have been trying to say or that you just messages that you should have been getting about your kids. But in the busyness, we just miss some of these things. Or that you might know, but then being at home with them, it really just magnifies it. So I want to read a few pages from this book, and as I read, I'm going to stop and kind of flesh out a few of the ideas, because he says it so well, but, and this is kind of an obscure long book. This is not one that I want to be like, oh yeah, everybody should read this book. Like, no. I'm going to come back to this book soon and kind of like really get into it, reread it more myself and summarize it. But there's such a powerful concept that is the premise of the whole book that he introduces in the first few pages. So stick with me. I'm going to try to read it in a way that you can really hear it. I know listening to reading can be kind of different. But okay, chapter one, in a nutshell, the Acorn Theory and the Redemption of Psychology. He says, there is more in a human life than our theories of it allow. I totally agree with that. And I feel like that is kind of the premise for like, that's my premise for everything that I do. Like, yeah, I think definitely. Okay. Sooner or later, something seems to call us onto a particular path. You may remember this something as a single moment in childhood when an urge out of nowhere, a fascination, a peculiar turn of events struck like an annunciation. This is what I must do. This is what I've got to have. This is who I am. He says this book is about that call. If not this vivid or sure, the call may have been more like gentle pushings in the stream in which you drifted unknowingly to a particular spot on the bank. Looking back, you sense that fate had a hand in it. This book is about that sense of fate. And that idea of fate is what I want to talk to you about, specifically talking about our children and being at home with our kids. And I want to talk about having a perspective shift in how we view our children. These kinds of enunciations and recollections determine biography as strongly as memories of abusive horror. but these more enigmatic moments tend to be shelved. Our theories favor traumas, setting us the task of working them through. Despite early injury and all the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, we bear from the start the image of a definite individual character with some enduring traits. Now, he comes from psychology, the industry, you know, the tradition of psychology, and he's a doctor of psychology. And so part of a large aim for him in this book is he is urging his colleagues and kind of the psychological community to reassess and change the place that they come from in doing psychological work and treatment and therapy and all of that. And so he talks some about how in that space they focus so much on like trauma and understanding trauma. And he says, hey, we don't need to just look at trauma. There's also a defining image. Every childhood shows hints of the destiny that is intended, of who that child is meant to be, of their calling, their gifts, their, like, that thing that captivates them that they want to devote their life to. Of a definite individual character with some enduring traits, he says, this book is about that power of character. Because the traumatic view of early years so controls psychological theory of personality and its development, the focus of our rememberings, remembering our past, and the language of our personal storytelling have already been infiltrated by the toxins of these theories. So he's talking about how the stories that we tell ourselves about our lives affect us, and about how we give too much prominence to the trauma and the bad part of it. He says, our lives may be determined less by our childhood than by the way we have learned to imagine our childhoods. I totally agree. How we think about things becomes what they are to us. We are, this book shall maintain, less damaged by the traumas of childhood than by the traumatic way we remember childhood as a time of unnecessary and externally caused calamities that wrongly shaped us. Right? So he's talking about a victim mentality here. Because when we say, oh, I could have been whatever, but my parents did this, or oh, I didn't have this opportunity, or oh, when I was a child, such and such always happened, and that's why I am the way I am. That's why I am where I am. It becomes an explanation, which becomes kind of a cop-out. It becomes a way to say, oh, if only, then I could have been something else, which is the wrong mental direction to be going and thinking about who you are and why you are where you are. He says, so this book wants to repair some of that damage by showing what else was there, is there, in your nature. It wants to resurrect the unaccountable twists that turned your boat around in the eddies and shallows of meaninglessness, bringing you back to feelings of destiny. For that is what is lost in so many lives and what must be recovered, a sense of personal calling that there is a reason I am alive. And I think he's totally right on, because how much despair is there in this world? How much depression? And it comes from this meaninglessness that I want to make the argument through all of my work that our theology is missing from our lives. That our beliefs about God that we have left behind spirituality and spiritual beliefs, and that we need to reinvent and recover them. I think as a society, we're burned out on God, but that's because we're holding on to an old view of God or a mistaken view of God, and we need to reassess and recover and be willing to change it and reinvent it, and have a new experience of God for ourselves and create a new theology that matches and serves where we are. And I think when we do that, we're going to recover our sense of meaning and purpose in such, and a new real sense of our identity in such a deep, powerful, and profound way. And I think one important aspect of that is this concept that he's talking about. Okay. Not the reason to live, not the meaning of life in general, or a philosophy of religious faith. This book does not pretend to provide such answers. So he's not trying to talk about religion, but I'm going to apply this to spirituality. because I think it's all connected. I think all these authors that talk about all these great things, I was just reading something by Brendan Burchard, and I was like, oh, man, he gets it. He says all of it except actually saying it when it comes to the truth that everything is spirit and everything is energy. The way Brendan Burchard talks about energy, I love it because he's helping people think in those terms without using the terms that will cause them to resist viewing life that way. Anyways, but it does speak to the feelings that there is a reason my unique person is here, and that there are things I must attend to beyond the daily round, and that give the daily round its reason. Feelings that the world somehow, wants me to be here, that I am answerable to an innate image, which I am filling out in my biography. And we'll talk about balance here, but I think our current culture has swung so far in the direction of just like, there's no fate, there's no destiny, there's just chance, there's just my actions, I'm on my own, and I just do what I do, and I react to other people doing what they do, and reach our own agents, and that's just all there is. Just this like super natural kind of approach, right? That comes from all that train of thought. But I think we'll get to the balance is co-creation. We co-create with the divine. We do have free will. And we are an agent and we do affect things, but there is a broad destiny that we're working within. And we chart a path within that, but it's a co-creation. It's a healthy tension. It's a give and take. It's a balance. It's a, as you awaken to it, it's like a dance. It's like a partnership. It's working together with spirit. But what I think he's really pushing on, bringing to the forefront, is that part that we're missing. But I'm just saying we're not going to swing all the way from we have all the control to we have none of the control. It's all fate. That's not true either. But I think he is helping provide a counterbalance to what we've swung too far in the other direction. But I love this, feelings that the world somehow wants me to be here, that I'm answerable to an innate image. I think our world needs that message, and I'm concerned that if we don't recover this for our generation, we're not going to teach it to our kids, and they're not going to have it yet, and they're going to have the same struggle and wrestle that we had if we don't find a new way for us to internalize the meaning of life so that we can teach our kids. The world wants you to be here. You have an innate image. You can discover what that is. You can live out that calling. I'm going to need water. That's over. That innate image is also the subject of this book, as it is the subject of every biography. And we will encounter many biographies through these pages. He tells lots of stories about Olympic swimmers that realized they wanted to swim when they were 8, you know, and stuff like that. And a toddler that's like captivated by a violin that wants a violin, and they get a toy violin for their birthday or something, and they like want a real violin, and they grow up to become like this amazing, you know, violinist. Like, he tells lots of those kinds of stories. Okay. The biography question haunts our Western subjectivity as its immersion in therapies of self-show. Everyone in therapy or affected by therapeutic reflection, even as diluted by the tears of TV talk, is in search of an adequate biography. How do I put together into a coherent image the pieces of my life? How do I find the basic plot of my story? We love story. As humans, we're captivated by story. When we hear somebody else's story, we are moved in whatever way that story naturally moves you. Whether to give or to rejoice or whatever the emotion of that story is, we are so captivated by story. And he's right. We are compelled to discover our own story and to give meaning to our own story. And when we cannot create a meaningful story for ourselves, we fall into depression because we come from meaning and we have meaning. And without meaning, it's like water. Like we need meaning. Without a vision, the people perish. Right. To uncover the innate image, we must set aside the psychological frames that are usually used and mostly used up. They do not reveal enough. He's talking about the current psychological perspective. They trim a life to fit the frame. Developmental growth, step by step, from infancy through troubled youth to midlife crisis and aging to death. Plotting your way through an already planned map, you are on an itinerary that tells you where you have been before you get there, or like an averaged statistic foretold by an actuary in an insurance company. The course of your life has been described in the future perfect tense. Or, if not the predictable highway, then the offbeat journey. Accumulating and shedding incidents without pattern. Itemizing events for a resume organized only by chronology. This came after that. Such a life is a narrative without plot. A narrative without plot. So it has an order and it happens, but the plot is the story that gives the events the meaning. It's focused on a more and more boring central figure, me, wandering in the desert of dried out experiences. He says, okay, that's good. I believe we have been robbed of our true biography, that destiny written into the acorn, and we go to therapy to recover it. He says, that innate image can't be found, however, until we have a psychological theory that grants primary psychological reality to the call of fate. He says our psychological theory is missing this idea of fate. And he says, without it, we can't have the conversation we need to have. And I think I love this because I want to say a parallel thing about theology and our beliefs about God, and that without certain concepts, we can't have the beliefs that we need in order to live the life that we're meant to live. So our language and our theology matter. Okay. Otherwise, your identity, he says, without this concept of call, he says, otherwise, your identity continues to be that of a sociological consumer determined by random statistics, and the unacknowledged daemon's urgings appear as eccentricities, okay, compacted with angry resentments and overwhelming longings. Repression, the key to personality structure in all therapy schools, is not of the past, but of the acorn and the past mistakes we have made in our relation with it. Okay, this is one of my favorite statements that he makes, similar to the very first one. He says, we dull our lives by the way we conceive them. Yes, that is his point. We have stopped imagining them with any sort of romance, any fictional flair. This is why we are depressed as a nation. So this book also picks up the romantic theme, daring to envision biography in terms of very large ideas such as beauty, mystery, and myth. We need more beauty, mystery, and myth in our lives. That's part of why I do what I do. In keeping with the romantic challenge, this book also risks the inspiration of big words. He says, I'm going to risk to use these big words because we need them. He says, such as vision and calling, privileging them over small reductions. He's talking about lesser words that don't mean the same thing. He says, we do not want to belittle what we do not understand. Even when, in a later chapter, we do look carefully at genetic explanations, we find mystery and myth there too. At the outset, we need to make clear that today's main paradigm for understanding a human life, the interplay of genetics and environment, he says, that omits something essential, the particularity you feel to be you. So he's talking about, are we just a combination of genetics and environment? What about the fact that we feel that we are us and that we are meant to be us and not someone else? Not someone else. By accepting the idea that I am the effect of a subtle buffeting between heredity and societal forces, I reduce myself to a result. And if you're reduced to a result, that's why you feel like a victim, in the sense that you feel not powerful and you feel a lack of ownership. Because if you are a product, then that which determines what you are has already happened. And then you just are what you are. The more my life is accounted for by what already occurred in my chromosomes, by what my parents did or didn't do, and by my early years now long past, the more my biography is the story of a victim. I am living a plot written by my genetic code, ancestral heredity, traumatic occasions, parental unconsciousness, societal accidents. So he says, this book wants to lift the pall a victim mentality from which individual people cannot recover until the theoretical paradigms that give rise to that mentality have been seen through and set aside. We are victims primarily of theories before they are put into practice. The current American identity as victim is the tail side of the coin whose head is brightly displays the opposite identity, the heroic self-made man, carving out destiny alone and with unflagging will. Victim is flip side of hero. More deeply, however, we are victims of academic, scientific, and even therapeutic psychology whose paradigms do not sufficiently account for or engage with and therefore ignore the sense of calling, that essential mystery at the heart of each human life. So he's talking about how our modern intellectual paradigms don't account for what I would say are spiritual concepts, such as calling. And he tries to make an argument from his perspective, which I think is useful and valid. Like, his perspective is his perspective, and he's paving the way for what, you know, my generation is going to talk about. He wrote this in 1996. Yeah. He kind of tries to say that this doesn't have to be spiritual. He talks about recovering what psychology is meant to be and how they should be talking about, which I totally agree. More power to him. I'm like, yes. And now I want to come along and say, okay, what is psychology missing? Psychology is missing what Carolyn Miss would say, a sacred vocabulary. She talks about how we have lost sacred words and, yeah, the stories we tell ourselves matter, and the language and the terms that we use matter, and we can't talk about things without the language in the same way that we can once we're using that language. That language is empowering. Okay. In a nutshell, then, this book is about calling, about fate, about character, about innate image. Together they make up the Acorn Theory, which holds that each person bears a uniqueness that asks to be lived and that is already present before it can be lived. All right, where does he talk about? All right, maybe I should have started with the Acorn Theory. But basically, the Acorn Theory is just this idea that within the acorn exists the imprint and all the information to become a huge, strong oak tree, right? Just as the mighty oak's destiny is written into the tiny acorn, the destiny of the human is written into the baby or the child. This is so good. Okay. Reading life backward enables you to see how early obsessions are the sketchy preformations of behaviors now. Sometimes the peaks of early years are never surpassed. Reading backward means that growth is less the key biographical term than form, and that development only makes sense when it reveals a facet of the original image. Still, the innate image of your fate holds all in the co-presence of today, yesterday, and tomorrow. Your person is not a process or a development. You are that essential image that develops if it does. As Picasso said, I don't develop, I am. For this is the nature of an image, any image. It's all there at once. When you look at a face before you, at a scene out your window, or at a painting on the wall, you see a whole gestalt. All the parts present them simultaneously. One bit does not cause another bit or precede it in time. It doesn't matter whether the painter put the reddish blotches in last or first, the gray streaks as an afterthought or as originating structure, or whether they are leftover lines from a prior image on that piece of canvas. What you see is exactly what you get all at once, and the face too. Its complexion and features form a single expression, a singular image given all at once. So too the image in the acorn. You are born with a character. It is given, a gift, as the old stories say, from the guardians upon your birth. Okay, here we go. Here he's going to tell the... Yes, here we go. Oh man, this is already long. Should I put this in two parts and just make you wait till tomorrow? Most people aren't going to hear this until tomorrow's already available. Well, let's finish the myth. Okay, This book sets out on a new course based on an old idea. Each person enters the world called. The idea comes from Plato, his myth of Ur, at the end of his most well-known work, The Republic. I can put the idea in a nutshell. Okay, so here's his summary of the myth that he's talking, that all this is based on, Plato's myth. Okay. The soul of each of us is given a unique daemon before we are born, and it has selected an image or pattern that we live on Earth. This soul companion, the daemon, guides us here. In the process of arrival, however, we forget all that took place and believe we come into the world empty. The daemon remembers what is in your image and belongs to your pattern, and therefore your daemon's kind of like your guardian angel. Your daemon is the carrier of your destiny. As explained by the greatest of later Platonists, Plotinus, around 8200, we elected the body, the parents, the place, and the circumstances that suited the soul, and that, as the myth says, belong to its necessity. This suggests that the circumstances, including my body and my parents, whom I may curse, are my soul's own choice, and I do not understand this because I have forgotten. So that we do not forget, Plato tells the myth, and in the very last passage, says that by preserving the myth, we may better preserve ourselves and prosper. In other words, the myth has a redemptive psychological function, and a psychology derived from it can inspire a life founded on it. He's talking about how this story empowers us to live life in an empowering way. The myth leads also to practical moves. The most practical is to entertain the ideas implied by the myth in viewing your biography, ideas of calling, of soul, of daemon, of fate, of necessity, all of which will be explored in the pages that follow. Then the myth implies, we must attend very carefully to childhood to catch early glimpses of the daemon in action, to grasp its intentions and not block its way. The rest of the practical implications swiftly unfold. A, recognize the call as a prime fact of human existence. B, align life with it. C, find the common sense to realize that accidents, including the heartache and the natural shocks the flesh is heir to, belong to the pattern of the image, are necessary to it, and help fulfill it. A calling may be postponed, avoided, intermittently missed. It may also possess you completely. Whatever, eventually it will win out. It makes its claim. The daemon does not go away. For centuries, we have searched for the right term for this call. The Romans named it your genius, the Greeks your daemon, the Christians your guardian angel. The Romantics, like Keats, said the call came from the heart, and Michelangelo's intuitive eye saw an image in the heart of the person he was sculpting. Okay, let's stop there. So much, but yeah, I'm just going to stop because this is long, but yeah, so to wrap this up right now, think about that story and that myth and this concept of the imprinted image on the acorn that will become the oak tree, and kind of along the same lines as this in the field. She kind of tracks science that is, it's like, you know, spiritual, you know, modern and ancient spiritual teachers and spiritual traditions are kind of over here. And this book, you know, is kind of talking about quantum physics and scientists that are exploring, you know, the envelope with that kind of against, you know, what the core establishment of science is kind of doing. It's moving much slower, but you've got some scientists here on the periphery, and the one is meeting the other. Quantum physics is agreeing with, you know, what spiritual teachers have been telling us for a long time. Anyways, in this book, she talks about how they can see and measure and kind of, they've found there's a force field around living creatures. And they said a salamander has a force field, a field that you can identify that represents the full imprinted form of the salamander, and that energy field of that imprinted shape exists in the egg. I wonder if I have that. I can't find it right now. But this is why I name my index cards. Anyways, so I think there's two equally fascinating applications for this. One, obviously, for yourself. The other, for your children. So, but what I want to encourage you for today and for this week is to kind of apply this concept to your children and just think about, let go of the heaviness and the striving of doing all the schoolwork and checking all the boxes and doing all the things. Like, yes, you know, be respectful of what the teachers have asked you to do and what your kids feel that they need to get done, and encourage your kids to take ownership of whatever, you know, they need to do. But as a family, I want to encourage you to create a mood of flow and a spirit of joy and creativity, and help your children to set the tone for your children to relax into this season, to help them to be at peace with being at home. And yes, they miss their friends. Yes, they miss their activities. But whatever tone you set, whatever story you tell, whatever perspective you take and view that you choose to take and believe about this season is what will trickle down to your family and your children. And so I want to encourage you to truly internalize and see this time as an opportunity to slow down, to be present with your kids, and to really listen to them and to watch them and to ask God to show you, what is that imprint in my children? What is that calling? What is that destiny? What can the daemon, the guardian angel, what is there that I can ask, you know, show it to me so I can align with my child's destiny in this? And then, I mean, asking and you receive, you will begin to see things. And then practically, this is an amazing time. You have more time. And yes, the juggling is crazy. The logistics may be crazy, but your children have more time at home. And you can get super creative with resources. Whenever we do scientific experiment stuff, I'm always like, oh, a paperclip is suddenly like has potential. And this, children are so creative. Like, you have whatever you have in your house, you know, go find the things in the nooks and crannies and put them to use. But consider what Spirit shows you, what God shows you about your children, and use this extra time to give them more space and more opportunity to explore whatever it is that they want to explore, that they're interested in, that will feed their soul, that you know, just give them room for this concept of fate and destiny and calling and this innate imprint. This can be space for them to exercise that and to own that and to live into that a little bit more when their whole day is not as rigidly structured, and they have more space, more room, more time right now. And I believe this is the kind of thing where this exercise right now, like, yes, we have more time every summer, but when things get shaken up like this, we see things that we didn't see another time, because these experiences have that unique grace in them. So what you experience now and learn now with your children, this can be something that becomes a tradition or becomes a continued experience that flows into every summer. Okay, I'm going to stop there. I love you. I want to encourage you to love on your children, to let go of the striving, to give them the freedom to be them, to bless them as who they are, to bless them to be them. And to just create an atmosphere and an expectation for that, to let each of your children relax and shine and feel more into their uniqueness. So, I know this was long. I hope you enjoyed it. All right, all my love.